From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The director of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, has warned that Al-Qaeda is planning an attack to disrupt the elections. On today's Fresh Air, we examine some of the vulnerabilities in Homeland Security. We talk with Stephen Flynn, author of the new book, America the Vulnerable. He was the lead author of a report on Homeland Security issued by a bipartisan task force in 2002. Also, scandal and a morality crusade in the early days of Hollywood. We talk with Jerry Stahl about I, Fatty, his new novel based on the life of silent film star Fatty Arbuckle. Stahl is also the author of the memoir, Permanent Midnight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The death toll of U.S. troops in Iraq reached 900 today as an American soldier was killed by a roadside bomb during a patrol in a town about 45 miles north of Baghdad. The U.S. casualty rate has fallen sharply since April, when 135 American servicemen and women were killed in the worst month of violence since President Bush declared the end of major hostilities. U.S. military officials say fighting between U.S. troops and Iraqi insurgents continued in several areas today, including the city of Ramadi. A hospital spokesman in the city said 5 Iraqis were killed and about 17 wounded. 4 Iraqis were killed today by a car bomb in eastern Baghdad. A new, not-yet-released report prepared for the U.S. Army argues that the Iraqi Army's ineptitude played as big a role in the quick fall of Saddam Hussein as America's advanced technology. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
The Internal Army report obtained by NPR cautions against viewing the major combat phase of the Iraq War as an endorsement of the Pentagon's transformation emphasis on speed, precision, and high-tech weaponry. The report, Toppling Saddam, was prepared for the Army by the Strategic Studies Institute. It documents Iraqi Army incompetence, including failure to shoot straight or exploit serious vulnerabilities in American supply lines. Retired Army Colonel Doug McGregor.
The generals were always in pursuit of fantastic illusions of Iraqi military power. There was plenty of information available before we went into Iraq that made it very clear that we were not dealing with a serious enemy.
The report concludes that the same advanced U.S. technology against a skilled opponent in future conflicts would likely produce a very different military outcome. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Washington.
Firefighters battling wildfires in the West report progress on some major blazes, but new ones are breaking out. 5 major new wildfires are reported in California, Nevada, and Utah, while 6 existing blazes were declared contained. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
The video is dramatic and the losses tragic, but the latest numbers from the National Interagency Fire Center show that most of the West is below average in wildfires this year. The exception is Alaska, where 3.7 million acres have burned. But in the lower 48, less than 1 million acres have been scorched so far, half the average for this time of year. Relatively cool and wet weather in parts of the West help keep fires from sparking and spreading. But summer heat is expected to dry out the thicker grasses and brush the wet spring left behind. Potential for wildfire is growing. 10 states from Alaska to New Mexico already score very high to extreme in conditions conducive to fire. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
The Dow lost 102 to 10,046. The Nasdaq was down 42 to 1874. This is NPR News. The White House and the Republican-controlled Congress appear to be deadlocked over legislation to extend some tax cuts. House and Senate leaders had agreed on a plan that would extend tax cuts for parents, married couples, and some workers by 2 years. Those cuts are currently scheduled to expire at the end of December. The 2-year compromise was designed to attract the support of Republican moderates who fear that a longer extension could help drive up record budget deficits. The Bush administration is insisting that the cuts be extended for 5 years. 2 Canadian women are the first same-sex couple to seek a divorce in that country. They were among the first to get married when same-sex marriage laws were changed in Ontario. Richard Reynolds reports from Toronto.
Same-sex marriage has been legal here in Ontario since June of last year, when a court threw out the province's marriage law as unconstitutional. Just 1 week later, two women known only as J.H. and M.M. were married. But it didn't last long, and they split up just 5 days later. Now they want to make the split permanent. But Canada's divorce laws don't recognize same-sex unions. In Canada, marriage is administered provincially, but divorce is federal jurisdiction, so it is easier for same-sex couples to get hitched than it is to split up. The federal government has pledged to fully legalize same-sex marriage, but is waiting for an opinion requested from Canada's Supreme Court. For NPR News, I'm Richard Reynolds in Toronto.
Secretary of State Colin Powell is scheduled to meet with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan tomorrow to talk about ways to stop what they say is ethnic cleansing in southern Sudan. The two leaders may call for action from the UN Security Council. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR shop introduces the limited edition NPR Tivoli Model 1 radio, designed by Henry Kloss for both performance and simplicity, available at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If September 11th, 2001 was a wake-up call, clearly America has fallen back asleep, writes my guest Stephen Flynn. In his new book, America the Vulnerable, he warns that we appear to be unwilling to do what must be done to make our society less of a target. Flynn was the lead author of a 2002 report on homeland security released by a bipartisan task force chaired by former Senators Gary Hart and Warren Rudman. Flynn is currently a senior fellow in national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He worked in the White House military office during the administration of George H.W. Bush and worked with Richard Clark on the National Security Council in the Clinton White House. He also spent 20 years as a commissioned officer in the U.S. Coast Guard. Earlier this month, the director of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, warned Americans that al-Qaeda is planning an attack in an effort to disrupt the elections. I asked Stephen Flynn if he thinks this kind of warning to Americans is helpful.
One of my concerns is that we've got ourselves into a rather paternalistic approach to dealing with this new threat environment where the federal government basically says, we're going to continue to try to do our job of securing you by defeating terrorism overseas and taking some measures here at home. We can't tell you much about them because we don't want the bad guys to know what we're up to. And your job, citizens, is to essentially shop and travel, to trust us. I think this is an inherently flawed paradigm. We, the people, are the most likely targets. Our day-to-day, the underpinnings of our society, are the most likely targets. And we need to be brought into the conversation about what the risks are, what the threat is, and most importantly, about how we design solutions to deal with these problems, to manage the risk that these threats pose.
In the bipartisan task force report on homeland security that you were the lead author of in 2002, you concluded America remains dangerously unprepared to prevent and respond to catastrophic terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. Do you think homeland security has gotten any better since you wrote that in 2002?
Not much. On a scale of 1 to 10, if I put it in that range where 1 is a bullseye, we're a bullseye, and 10 is we're secure, we're certainly a 1 on 9/11. You know, today we're maybe at a 3. I assign it as a failing grade precisely because while there has been some progress making some efforts of addressing some of our most glaring vulnerabilities and our very limited capacity as a government to deal with these threats, they've really been on the margins, and that stands in marked contrast to the investment we've been willing to make and the sacrifice, even in life, to deal with terrorism as an overseas problem. We've got a situation where the national security establishment essentially focuses on water's edge out, and that was an outgrowth of the fact that we had almost two centuries of living in the most peaceful corner of the planet. We had friendly neighbors to the north and to the south, big oceans to the east and west, and there were no enemy boots on our ground in the 20th century. And so we dealt with security as something that we handled overseas, on bases on our soils of our allies or in actual combat with adversaries on their soil. And that didn't change on 9/11. What we did is we essentially said, oh, we need something new to deal with the fact that there's vulnerabilities here at home. Let's create something different than national security. We'll call it homeland security. But all the eggs remain heavily in the national security basket. For instance, there are 361 commercial seaports in this country. And the CIA has said that the most likely way in which a weapon of mass destruction would come to the United States is by sea. And the United States has spent close to $500 million on grants in 3 years to help those seaports get more secure, which may sound a lot of money to many Americans. That's what we're spending every 3 days in Iraq. Basically, we're spending every 3 days in the war on terror in Iraq what we spent in three years on dealing with one of our most serious vulnerabilities.
Do you think that the war in Iraq is using up money that should have been spent on homeland security? Is the war in Iraq, I don't know if you see this as a zero-sum game or not, but is the war in Iraq taking money away from homeland security, or do you see it as like helping the efforts even though it's money being spent in another country?
We're a very wealthy country, and we have a sort of second-to-none military, and we can afford both an offense and a defense. My focus has been primarily on the defense side of it, and my concern that there's been so little effort made to make us less attractive as a target. So, you know, when we're faced with a situation as we are now, where our enemies have to be creative if they're going to challenge U.S. power, and they're most likely to do that by not confronting our military directly, then we have to begin to think about, okay, why do they think they can get such a big bang for their buck by using that tactic of catastrophic terrorism? They will get that as long as the opportunity is rich to succeed and there's cascading effects that come from doing that. Therefore, by making ourselves more resilient as a society, taking the things that are most valuable to us and protecting it, we get actually both a tactical and a strategic advantage. The tactical one is that the harder you make it something to strike with, the more of an effort the bad guys have to make, a terrorist would have to make, to essentially try to compromise it. They'd need more money. They need more expertise. They'd have to take more time in the planning of the cycle of it. They'd have to rehearse. All that gives you a leg up on intelligence. They're giving off some smoke signal that would ideally help you trip them up. But the other is they're doing this with the expectation that they can get a big bang for their buck. And if, in fact, they target things and they end up killing people and hurting a bit of property, but there's no ripple effect across the society, then they haven't, in fact, had a very successful tool of warfare. And so it's not a defeatist position I'm trying to maintain by trying to deal with this core reality of our vulnerability. There is, in fact, a military value to having a good defense.
What are some of the places that you think we're most vulnerable?
One of the areas that I have focused on that is a great vulnerability remains this container. These are the 8 foot by 8 foot by 40 foot boxes that fit on our trains and trucks and ships. They're basically the assembly lines, and they are the back shelves of our retailing manufacturing sector. That is, you know, Walmart doesn't have a back room, and most factories don't have much in the way of storeroom. It's in the transportation system. So the threat scenario is that there's a tremendous opportunity, given the sheer numbers of these. It's somewhere between 16 and 18 million containers. And that right away should set off some alarms. We don't know how many containers there really are in the world right now, plus or minus a couple of million, never mind what's in them. Each one could hold up to 32 tons of material. That is loaded virtually anywhere on the planet. Somebody puts a 50-cent seal on it, on the door, and it's off to the races. Everybody in the logistics transportation business is to get it out of their hands and into somebody else's hands as quickly as possible. A container that originates in Asia, arrives in the United States, may have 17 waypoints, stop points, where it's handled by one set of players and handed off to somebody else. That's a system that has ripe in terms of opportunity for somebody to put something bad in, potentially a weapon of mass destruction. But the real danger comes from when that explosion goes off. And I talk about how this could happen in an Al-Qaeda-style scenario here in the U.S. with three or four of these going off simultaneously. It creates a sudden concern about all containers. And so the reaction, the political pressure becomes, turn it all off until we can sort this out. If we shut down our ports for a period of 2 to 3 weeks and closed our borders to sort this stuff out, and believe me, it would take a long time to try to do it from scratch, We're talking about shutting the global trade system. And it's not because the terrorists did that. We did that to ourselves because that was the only tool in the tool bag to deal with the risk.
Why don't you describe what a container is? Because it's not just like a little cardboard box. Describe what a typical shipping container is and what it would take for an actual inspector to, you know, to inspect the container.
A typical container would be the kind of thing that you would see probably if you moved your house. I mean, it's the kind of thing that fits in the back of an 18-wheeler. If you took all your household goods and you put them inside a truck, that truck is the average size of most containers that are out there. They come in the 20-foot size and the 40-foot size. And they are 8 feet by 8 feet in terms of width and height. A ship coming into, the bigger ships that come into our largest port like Los Angeles and Long Beach can be carrying up to 3,000 of these 40-foot by 8-foot by 8-foot boxes that can hold up to 30 tons of material each on a single ship, offloaded in a period of about 12 to potentially 36 hours. That's what we're talking in terms of volume moving through through the system. They're the things you see on a rail car. They're the things that you see on trucks. They're so all around us, we hardly pay any attention to them.
So in other words, we're X-raying my baggage at the airport, but we're not X-raying these huge containers.
Yeah, there is, in fact, new technologies out there that will allow us to scan the contents of a container, but we don't have much of it. And there was none in any seaport prior to 9/11 but one that was looking for actually stolen cars leaving Southern Florida. We were monitoring the border with Mexico to some extent. This is where we first deployed this equipment, looking for illegal immigrants coming through in some drug shipments. But there has been some buying of these equipment, but we basically use them for only on somewhere in the order of about 2 to 3% of all the containers that arrive in the U.S. may run through some of the scanning equipment. And in some ports, they still don't have working equipment, so that's more a physical check. And to give you an idea about the time it takes to the physical side, the rule of thumb in the business is about 5 hours with three people. It's a...
For one container.
For one container. Imagine, I mean, moving your house, right? You fill up a whole container, go in there and empty it and check it out. We're talking a lot of space and a lot of stuff potentially, and it's a physically demanding exercise. So that's where these technologies can be applied. One very interesting pilot I've been involved with, for instance, is out in the port of Hong Kong. Hong Kong is the world's busiest container terminal, container port. It moved about 19 million containers last year through this one port. And out there, they're beginning experiment where they're going to scan every container coming into a very busy, one of the busiest terminals in the world. It's one that goes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The scan and image can be done in about 10 to 15 seconds. And it's just put as the trucks queue up or, line up to get into the gate. The technology is there. We could deploy that kind of scanning technology in all the world's major ports for about $500 million, and we could clean up probably the rest of them pretty quickly as well for another $300 or so. If that, again, sounds like a lot of money, we will spend $600 million buying four F-22 fighters for the Air Force this upcoming year. So we are certainly talking about a different scale of thinking when we're talking about making these investments.
So what do you think is holding us back from making this investment for scanning equipment for the ports? Is it a lack of money? Is it differing priorities?
Well, part of the issue is the scanning is only one piece of it. I mean, one of the challenges that we have with, and this is a case I try to make in the book, that any single point security solution always travels, we call it path of diminishing returns. That is, it gets more and more expensive for less and less security. And inevitably, it always creates this balloon effect or this push effect that basically the bad guys know what you're doing, so they move somewhere else. The notion I've been trying to advance overall is this idea of layered security that takes advantage of a law of probabilities, which is that if I have 5 60% solutions layered together, I get a 99% interception rate. This works as if I had a 60% chance to bobbing at an apple to bite it, and I get 5 shots at it, I will get it 99% of the time. And so we don't need to have perfect solutions for everything, but you need to have a number of them in a layered way. So in the case of this problem, I want some process that you have what I call a birth certificate. Somewhere at the origin point, you can feel comfortable about what was put in here was legitimate and authorized. That's a 6% solution potentially because people could be corrupted. Then I want to track the container and its integrity by putting a device inside, a GPS and other kinds of things that would track it to its port. Then I want to scan it, and then I want to track the ship, and then I want to spot check it on the arrival port. Those would be 5 layers. Any one of those layers could potentially compromise, but all together, they basically create a pretty powerful deterrent in terms of a system and give you lots of chances, lots of bites at the apple to intercept things. Now, that has cost. The cost of putting the technology into the boxes, for instance, and plus the scanning and so forth, certificate, we're probably talking about $50 per load, per shipment. But today we're spending about $3,000 to ship, a shipment of up to 30 tons from Asia to the West Coast. The transportation costs are really very cheap compared to the need for an efficient and reliable system that allows us to put our assembly lines and put our inventory into the transportation system. That's the higher good, and paying some prophylactic costs, some protective measures up front to deal with that seems to me the very smart way to go. This is just one sector. There's a whole series of infrastructures, networks that we have that have similar attributes, but we need to be thinking in those kinds of ways. So part of the problem is just people have not been willing to step back and think out the problem in a systemic way. If all want these sort of silver bullet one-shot approaches, which don't work, whether it's technology or whatever, and not willing to think a little more imaginatively about how we make this thing hum.
My guest is Stephen Flynn, author of the new book, America the Vulnerable. We'll talk more about homeland security after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Flynn. He's the author of the new book, America the Vulnerable, How Our Government is Failing to Protect Us from Terrorism. And he's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and was the lead author of a 2002 bipartisan task force report called America Still Unprepared, Still in Danger. How do you think the funding of Homeland Security should be divided between, you know, the federal government, state governments, and city governments? For example, New York's Mayor Bloomberg said recently, we're not getting our fair share of Homeland Security money. And he's furious because New York is such a high-risk target. And he feels that the federal government isn't doing enough to help New York protect itself. So I'm wondering, like, what you think that division of financial responsibility should be?
Well, first of all, I think many Americans would be surprised to know that the official strategy of the U.S. government in the form of the president's homeland security strategy says pretty explicitly the job that it's to do is national defense and border security, and the job of homeland security is primarily a job for the private sector and state and local governments. That's a division of labor they carved out without any real debate with the rest of us here, but that's pretty much where it is. Obviously, states and locals, particularly since 2001, don't have a lot of resources to make the kinds of investments that need to be made in the short term, and they can't run large deficits like the federal government does. The private sector is always worried about the bottom line, and it's not just simply they have their heads in the sand. If a company's CEO tried to do the right thing in his own sector with his own property to prop things up, and his neighbors to the left and right don't, then the bad guy is going to go to the weak point, but the whole sector is going to be affected. So we need common standards. They have to be uniformly enforced. The debate is about how we arrive at them and how we get there. So that is takes some government role. That takes some regulatory role. And it also takes that the engagement of citizens and private sector. And again, when we compare it to close to $500 billion the United States will spend this year on traditional national security, and about 5 to 7 cents on that dollar for what it will pay total on homeland security, it doesn't seem to me that we have much in the way of balance between the war on terror over there versus the war on terror on the home front.
There are mayors and governors who have been complaining that members of the police force, of the fire department, of people who would be fighting wildfires are in the reserves, and they're in Iraq. And therefore, there are shortages of the number of people on the forces, and these are first responders in many instances. So, in that sense, we're becoming understaffed in the war on terrorism on the home front.
That's clearly the case. Many of the people end up in the National Guard are people who are part-time policemen, or part-time sheriffs, part-time prison guards, or firefighters, and so forth. So, when they're called off to do the duty overseas, the cities and states are losing some of their critical experts and resources to deal with the threat if it plays itself out here at home. Now, that may have had a short-term necessity if we thought there was a clear and present threat overseas to deal with. But to the extent we're looking at a very long-term engagement of the Guard and the Reserves as a part of dealing with a long presence in Iraq, it only raises our vulnerability up greater that we don't have this expertise and professionals. You just can't create them overnight. These are people who live and are part of our communities here at home. So the exposure is quite high, and it's something that I very much worry about. Yeah, 9/11 happened here. And you know, it's a bit of a disconnect. On the one hand, we're told that the best defense is a good offense. We need to go over there so we don't have to deal with the enemy over here. And then you have the Secretary of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, stand up in front of the American people in early July and say, they're here, and they're likely to strike in the next few months. We have to confront the reality of 9/11. We're an open, hugely vulnerable society.
Now, you used to be in the Coast Guard. You spent, I think, 20 years in the Coast Guard. And you explain in your book, the Coast Guard is charged with protecting 95,000 miles of shoreline, and the force in the Coast Guard is about the same size as the New York Police Department. And that sounds like a pretty impossible task. What are some of the things you learned about the difficulties of Homeland Security by being in the Coast Guard?
I had a 20-year career as an active duty officer in the Coast Guard, and also was a graduate of the Coast Guard Academy. So I took this oath to protect and defend our nation at age 17 and went off and did it and retired just 2 years ago. One of the things I learned was a little sort of quirky thing, that our Defense Department didn't protect the nation or even its borders. That was something that agencies like the Coast Guard. But then when you look at who these agencies are, like the Coast Guard, who are charged with this, the Coast Guard is operating one of the oldest fleets in the world. It's both aviation and its ships, but its ships go back to some of them commissioned in the 1940s. The Coast Guard has been getting more money because it's a critical part of the Homeland Security Department than it did before 9/11, but it's more money to replace these decades-old ships in the next 25 years. That's when I sort of get at this point of not dealing with this level of urgency.
Do you think Homeland Security has been used as a political football in Congress? In other words, do you think politics are getting in the way of security?
There is no question that politics have gotten in the way of our taking on Homeland Security, and both sides are to blame. This is not a Democratic issue. It's not a Republican issue. It's an American issue. It's probably the most issue for our upcoming election. And my fear is that it may not even get much talked about. We'll talk about the war on terrorism as something overseas and how it could be fought differently. But we won't talk about, there's the core reality of 9/11, our own vulnerability. And I hope that the American people will press both these candidates into saying, what are you doing? What's your plan? What's your plan for dealing with this?
Well, Stephen Flynn, thank you so much for talking with us.
I thank you for very much having the chance to do so.
Stephen Flynn is the author of the new book, America the Vulnerable. He's a senior fellow in national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, publisher of The Summer Guest, a novel of love, family secrets, and a dying man's last wish by Justin Cronin, author of the collection Mary and O'Neill. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Fatty Arbuckle, Hollywood's first celebrity scandal, and the first morality campaign in Hollywood. We talked to writer Jerry Stahl about his novel, I, Fatty. Stahl is also the author of Permanent Midnight, a memoir about being addicted to heroin while writing popular TV shows. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The story we're going to hear about a Hollywood scandal and a morality crusade goes back to the silent film era. Fatty Arbuckle was one of silent film's biggest stars, the fat, funny man of many Keystone Cop comedies and other slapstick films. He was beloved and made a fortune, but his career was ruined in 1921 when he was accused of raping and murdering a model named Virginia Rappe. She died of an internal infection and a ruptured bladder that he was accused of causing through the rape. At his third trial, he was acquitted, but his name remained Hollywood poison. And his trial helped lead the way to the obsession with Hollywood scandal and to the first crusades against immorality in the movie industry. My guest Jerry Stahl has written a new novel based on Arbuckle's life called I, Fatty. Stahl is also the author of the popular memoir Permanent Midnight, which was about the years that he led a double life as a heroin addict and a writer of such TV shows as ALF. Let's start with a reading from the beginning of I, Fatty. The novel is written as if it were Arbuckle's memoir.
Even if I never touched Virginia Rappe or any other female, people had their reasons for believing, for wanting to believe I'd done something worth hating me for. I hated the name Fatty, and I made a career out of being that name. Buster Keaton said that to get people to love me, I became what I loathed the most. Buster was the one pal who stood by me through it all. So, before we really get going here, I just have to say this. Something strange happens when you lose everything. Something strange happened to me. All those years of being lucky, being successful, first comic actor to direct his own movies, first to make $1 million a year, I never felt comfortable. I had to pay a bootlegger to feel even half good, and after that, a croaker for narcotics. Once all my money and all my luck was used up, I could relax. I wanted to die, but at least the feeling was familiar. Does this make sense? Before the court lynched me, I was as big a success as Daddy was a failure, and I needed the hooch more than he did, sometimes more. After the St. Francis fiasco, I didn't need the drink. I mean, I did, but not the same way. Thanks to Virginia, I had an excuse to feel the way I had always felt, but could never explain when things were aces. But there I go, rushing the gag.
That's Jerry Stahl reading from his new book, I, Fatty. It's a novel based on the life of Fatty Arbuckle. Jerry, reading this novel made me feel like I was reading a history of early Hollywood, and there were actually a lot of parallels to what Hollywood is like today. But I'm wondering what made you think about Fatty Arbuckle as a subject.
I kind of stumbled across him by accident. I was really interested in the notion of American history and of America as a kind of pharmocracy, you know, doing a history of America via narcotics.
Oh, farm with a PH. Okay.
You're way ahead of me. Yeah, and see, back then, Bayer made heroin and sold it over the counter as the housewife's friend, as it was known, and to keep the kiddies from coughing at night. Whereas their new fangled crazy product, aspirin, was considered a little dicey. And then I stumbled across the fact that Fatty Arbuckle, at one point in his life, got so strung out on heroin that he had to wear a fat suit in public. And the notion of this guy leading the double junkie life of this fat suit and sweating in the horrific Los Angeles heat and then going home, taking it off and fixing was so riveting and so just somehow sad. It made me fall in love with the guy, so I decided to just write about Hollywood and that particular time in America via him.
You mean he was so wasted from the heroin that he lost so much weight he had to put on a fat suit?
That's right. Adolf Zucker had it made for him because he had to go on tour to promote films, but he could barely walk. He had lost a ton of weight because he had a carbuncle that an intern botched while trying to lance it, and as was the habit, no pun intended, of the day, he gave him heroin, and Fatty got strung out, and the studio said, okay, you have to kick it, and they built a kick bin in his own home, and when it was all over, he was so thin, he had to wear a fat suit.
What is Fatty Arbuckle's place in movie history as an actor and as a director?
His place is kind of twofold. One, he was the first guy to make $1 million a year, but on terms of artistic achievement, he invented the pie fight. And he was the first comic actor who got to direct his own movies. So, in fact, he was the first actor who had that kind of creative control to do what he wanted to do on screen.
When Fatty Arbuckle started in movies, movies were not particularly respectable the way you describe it. In your book, you write, and this is in Fatty Arbuckle's voice, working in flickers, as they were still being called, was out of the question. Everyone knew that the only people who'd lower themselves to step in front of a camera were stage actors who couldn't get work or couldn't stay sober enough to keep it if they got it. And then later on, he says, movies. Only people so poor they couldn't afford a vaudeville ticket go to the Nickelodeon. Why were movies so looked down on then?
Because they didn't really exist yet. And it's a really interesting thing because... In Hollywood at the time, apartment houses would literally have signs out front that said, no dogs, no colored, no actors. Because the kind of people who became actors were essentially the sort of, bartenders, wrestlers, dope fiends, all kind of peripheral riffraff who couldn't make it in what was considered legitimate stage work. So it was really embarrassing for Fatty. In fact, he was engaged. I'm going to call him Roscoe because he preferred to be called Roscoe. But he was engaged to be married, and he didn't want his future wife's parents, to know that he was an actor. Better he was a hobo or a pickpocket or something vaguely more respectable.
When he did start making movies, what kind of roles did he get? He was famous for being fat. How did that affect who he played on screen?
He always tended to play the innocent. He was one of those guys who somehow every other movie he was either in a diaper or in drag. And he had that kind of gender-free baby face kind of look that made him very endearing to people. You know how Rush Limbaugh used to say, I'm the kind of man who you could trust to babysit your daughter? He had sort of that quality, the Limbaugh-like sexless quality, before Rush, of course, got busted for drugs.
My guest is Jerry Stahl, author of the new novel, I, Fatty. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jerry Stahl, the author of the new novel, I, Fatty, based on the life of the silent film star Fatty Arbuckle, whose career was ruined by a scandal. Let's talk a little bit about the scandal that made Fatty Arbuckle even more famous than he already was. And I think a lot of people who don't know his movies at all know him as somebody who was involved in a scandal, even if they can't tell you what the scandal was. He was involved in this big Hollywood party. What was he alleged to have done that night?
Actually, it was a Hollywood party, but it was a Hollywood party in San Francisco, which is where a lot of the actors of the time would go because, remember, this was during Prohibition, and they thought that the liquor was better up in San Francisco and easier to get hold of. So he's in room 1221 of the swanky St. Francis Hotel, and to just give you the Cliff Notes version, there was an actress named Virginia Rappe who stumbled into his rooms during the party, and he already knew she had a reputation as being a rather nasty drunk and had in fact given half the Keystone Cops gonorrhea and the other half lice. But what happened is she started taking her clothes off, going into a fit, screaming, so not knowing what else to do, he put her down in the adjacent room where he was staying, and came back later to take a bath, and she was screaming and in fever and just in a horrific state. So not knowing what else to do, he decided that he took Buster Keaton's advice, who had once told him that when a woman is going crazy, what she really needs is something cold placed on her female area. So Fatty, you have to picture, is standing there in a towel, leaning over this woman, pressing a cold champagne bottle to her private area. as I like to call it, and it looked real bad. And a woman named Maud Delmont, who was a known blackmailer, came in, caught him in the act, and the next thing you know, Hearst is making a huge story out of it. The DA who wants to run for governor is using it as an excuse to get rid of these moral pariahs from Hollywood polluting San Francisco. And the right-wing Christian fundamentalists, who, of course, basically hated Jews for corrupting America's youth by running Hollywood, were using it as an excuse to shut down the entire industry. And he was innocent, and he couldn't have sex. He was impotent pretty much his whole life.
So was he accused of raping her or of raping her with the champagne bottle?
Both. He was accused of raping her and penetrating her with a foreign object, and then a lot of quotes were attributed to him by Hearst, who, another interesting kind of sideline, basically invented the tabloids behind Fatty Arbuckle's scandal.
And you mentioned he was impotent, and I have to say here that you earlier in the book say that his girth left him with a weakened nuptial muscle, which I thought was a very clever way of describing his impotency. How did you come up with the nuptial muscle?
I really love the lingo and argot of the time, and I just steeped myself in all kind of odd medical manuals, and there were weird slang dictionaries of the era, and there's all kind of different books and text. And after a while, sort of by process of osmosis, you start thinking in these kind of terms. When that was just a, sort of an age when the wisecrack and the scientific description, sort of like those, you know, bad health movies you had to watch in, you know, hygiene class in high school, I think it had its origin at that period. So that kind of language just began to permeate the way I wrote.
Well, so here's Fatty Arbuckle being accused of rape, and at the same time he's actually impotent. And you have him saying in your book, "The truth is, and I know this must sound loathsome, I preferred the penalty for committing sin to the shame of admitting that I couldn't commit it. There, I said it." It's a kind of interesting predicament.
It was a very bizarre dilemma the guy faced, because Hearst kept writing about his quote-unquote manly equipment, whereas his only defense would have been for his wife to get up in court and say, well, you know, his manly equipment is not particularly manly. But Fatty was so mortified by that that he literally was opting to go to the chair rather than admit that he couldn't do what he was, in effect, accused of doing.
And what was the information that was finally revealed that acquitted him in the third trial? There were two hung juries and then a third jury. The foreman of the third jury said, "Acquittal is not enough for Roscoe Arbuckle. We feel that a great injustice has been done."
They actually apologized to him. What was ultimately revealed was that the woman he was accused of raping, who had, of course, the Hearst papers had portrayed as a virginal young victim and a chaste young lady. At one point, they even decided she was descended from European royalty, had in fact been a prostitute since the age of 14 and had a series of abortions and had a botched abortion the day before.
So how did the information finally become admissible in court?
What happened was that once he was accused, it didn't matter if he was innocent or not, because it's sort of like if a clown commits a crime, you realize you're never going to look at him the same. So once he was accused and it was clear Paramount couldn't use him anymore, Adolf Zucker arranged for the DA to suppress all the information about his main accuser, Maud Delmont, who was herself a woman with about 21 allegations of blackmail against her. None of this came out in the first two trials. It finally came out in the last trial. So it was less about the fact of the botched abortion, because Fatty's lawyers were under the impression that had they put that out in court, it would have looked like they were slandering the good name of the dead woman, even though she never had a good name. So what came out instead was the fact that Maud Delmont, his main accuser, who the defense was never allowed to bring to court and the prosecution never brought into court, it came out that she, in fact, was completely morally bankrupt herself, and the case just went to pieces, and the deliberation of the jury took 6 minutes.
So from your knowledge of Hollywood history, would you say that this is the point in time when groups trying to uphold their vision of morality start accusing Hollywood of being morally bankrupt and morally corrupt?
Right, and it's a double-edged thing. It was that Hollywood was morally bankrupt and corrupting America's youth, but also with the subtler level of anti-Semitism, because the fact was that Hollywood was run by Jews. These people didn't like Jews, and the way to attack them and put them out of business was to accuse Hollywood itself of somehow having a conspiracy to corrupt good Christian children, which made what made Fatty's case so ironic is that even as this was welling up, Fatty's movies were one of the few that were considered like okay and family friendly by the morality squad. So the level of betrayal when this happy-go-lucky, threat-free clown turned out to have been a complete degenerate perv made it even more troubling for these people.
And did they know about his addiction to heroin?
Of course not, no.
Because heroin was was legal at the time, and a doctor prescribed it, so I was wondering.
It was legal, but it was also a big Hollywood secret. In fact, the first matinee idol of the day, a guy named Wallace Reed, was the guy who always played the upstanding, good guy, male lead, gorgeous, handsome, brave, in fact, died of heroin withdrawal and was an addict the entire time. And Paramount itself had been supplying him heroin to keep him going. Cecil B. DeMille had to give him a lecture on how he had to keep from doing drugs when, in fact, the studios would slip him morphine to keep the movies going.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jerry Stahl. He's the author of Permanent Midnight, and his new book is called I, Fatty. And it's a novelized version of the story of Fatty Arbuckle, who was a silent film star, nicknamed Fatty because he was obese. And he was the first Hollywood actor to become a millionaire, and his career was ruined by a scandal. Did you go back and read the articles of the time? Because, like, there's a few things you quote. I'm not sure if they're real or not. There's a passage in which he's comparing the articles about him with the reality of his life. He says, I had to do a lot of interviews, but they weren't really interviews. They were performances. They had me saying a lot of things I didn't know I'd said until I picked up a movie magazine, like, let me handle the Huns, boasts jokester Arbuckle. I'll find the Kaiser and sit on his head. Or they'd say, whatever success I've had, I credit to my mother's love and my father's guidance. That's from an article called Fatty Talks to Young People. And, of course, the real Fatty Arbuckle had a horrible family life, and he hated his parents. So did you actually find the articles that had these quotes?
Yeah, there's a ton of articles like that. And the really grotesque thing about it is Fatty's father, who used to beat him mercilessly, routinely, hated him on sight, blamed him for destroying his mother's womanhood and ultimately killing her. Fatty had always to describe him in articles as a, quote, gentleman farmer. And it just was the beginning of that kind of double life that went all the way, you know, continued to Rock Hudson, where the real acting job on the part of the actors was trying to play the part of real-life person that the studios were trying to pretend they were.
Let me say, when you say that his father accused Fatty Arbuckle of destroying his mother's womanhood, you mean during the childbirth process, that Fatty was so large
he
tore up his mother during the delivery.
He was a 16-pound baby, and mom was never the same, needless to say. And his father just hated the kid and beat him mercilessly when he was even around to beat him. And then, of course, in magazine interviews, Fatty got to talk about what a wonderful guy his dad was.
My guest is Jerry Stahl, author of the new novel, I, Fatty. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Jerry Stahl, the author of the new novel I, Fatty, based on the life of the silent film star Fatty Arbuckle, whose career was ruined by a scandal. Stahl is also the author of Permanent Midnight, a memoir about how he used to lead a double life as a heroin addict and a writer on such TV shows as Alf and Moonlighting. You know, in some ways, it seems to me that your novel is not only about Fatty Arbuckle, it's a kind of contrast between Fatty Arbuckle's life as somebody who grew up with a father who hated him, who ended up accidentally becoming a heroin addict because it was prescribed to him by his doctor, somebody who was unfairly accused of raping a woman to death, had his career ruined, someone who was so fat he couldn't even enjoy the conjugal pleasures of marriage. And yet he is the person who is, you know, ridiculed and condemned by the morality groups of the time, the morality groups who were all, you know, too happy to believe that he really was the murderer of the woman. And I think in some ways that this book is about the difference between your view of the human condition and the view expressed by certain groups who see themselves as upholders of morality.
That's really nicely put. It's the classic case of people who find themselves having the power to judge others, accusing somebody, not just unjustly, but for the wrong thing, because they are, for whatever reason, threatened. So here are people threatened by Fatty Arbuckle, a guy who can't even have sex. And I don't think it's that different from people wanting to ban gay marriage. It's as if somehow if gay people got married, all the straight men around would start marrying other men, you know? And it's just that crazy thing that happens when people become the arbiters of morality and are in a position to more or less destroy other people's lives by their own power.
Your view of the human condition seems to include things like people have appetites that aren't necessarily good for them. People have appetites that they can't necessarily fulfill. People are often born into conditions that are bleak and will taint the rest of their lives. That life can be very emotionally and spiritually difficult.
That is true, but what it boils down to for me, essentially, is that all our secrets are the same, no matter where we come from. Pain's pain, and it hurts. And the difference is that people in a position to somehow not experience what others go through feel entitled to judge how they react to those experiences. And what made this such a beautiful story for me was the fact that, you know, I fell in love with Fatty not just because he was a victim, but because he was just sort of emblematic of the classic wrong place, wrong time kind of guy who ends up at the, you know, being basically shunned by people who no doubt saw him as Satan's spawn and conveniently created an enemy that wasn't even there. And it just never changes. And the similarities to today are so obvious as to, you know, not even bear mentioning.
In the opening of your book, you are writing in your own voice.
Mm-hmm, in the introduction.
In the introduction. And you describe basically overdosing and falling unconscious on a street that happened to be the street that Fatty Arbuckle used to live on. Did that actually happen?
Yeah, this was a bizarre coincidence. Back in the early 80s, right at the dawn, pre-dawn of the crack era, there was a lot of drug sales going on Adams, where Mr. Arbuckle used to live. And at one point, I was sort of picked up by the police and told to, you know, as they used to say, lie lips down on the ground. And years later, I realized where that was in fact Fatty Arbuckle's front lawn. It's kismet.
We talked several years ago after your memoir, Permanent Midnight, was published about what it was like for you to have been a heroin addict and then, you know, get off it, and also what it was like to be writing for television when you were secretly a junkie and you know, shooting up in the bathroom. So it's been years since you were addicted. Is it still hard?
Let's just say I am certainly in touch with my own inner fatty since that experience. And it's tricky. One thing, what you believe is that, oh, I need all that stuff to make me, you know, write really dark and edgy. And if I get off all the drugs, I'm become a, you know, Johnny Bland guy. But one thing Hubert Selby, the late Hubert Selby, who kind of saved my life and really helped me with my writing, explained to me was, you don't get it. Once you give up the drugs and the alcohol and all that behavior, you don't become more boring. You realize how dark you really are, and there's no buffer. And that's when it really gets terrifying. And that has proved to be true. And at this point, you know, I'm that guy who goes and picks up my daughter after school and drives her home and does homework. So, you know, it's like on the one hand, you're Iggy Pop. On the other hand, you sort of become Fred McMurray. So at the end of the day, you're like Iggy McMurray, you know?
So was it scary to meet your demons without the sedative of heroin to intervene between the two of you?
Sure. But what you realize is that we're all in love with our pain. You know, we're so romanticized about the suffering this and the suffering that. And, you know, I get it. I mean, all my heroes were dope fiends, you know, Keith Richards and Miles Davis and Charlie Parker and Lenny Bruce. But, you know, when I was getting clean, Keith wasn't there with a warm towel. So you realize kind of the hollowness of that particular cliche. So I have changed cliches. And now I'm that guy on the other side. And it is much more surreal than drugs ever were, much more interesting, and much less predictable.
Well, Jerry Stahl, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Jerry Stahl's new novel about Fatty Arbuckle is called I, Fatty. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording featuring pianist James Williams. He died yesterday of liver cancer at the age of 53. He played with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers for 4 years, starting in 1977. Here he is with the Messengers in 78.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Ron Reagan Jr. Although the Republican convention will feature a tribute to his late father, Ron Reagan is speaking at the Democratic convention, where he will advocate stem cell research. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.